So I was juggling a lot, and that overwhelm, I could only manage it for so long, and I really had a nervous breakdown a little about a year and a half ago. I just had a breaking point where I just became completely overwhelmed with the cumulative effect of just so many years of stress and so many projects, and never being able to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and always feeling like I was in a sardine can. And as you can imagine, I just started to not like what I did anymore. Like, this stuff that used to make me really joyful, even my personal work, felt like a chore. And I was traveling, and I was on like something like 28 airplanes between 2015 and 2016. Yeah. And I was done. And I just said, I have to change this. There has to be another way. And I started making huge changes, and I'm happy to report that they're working.
Hi, I'm Daphne Cohn. Welcome to the Creativity Habit Podcast, conversations with the artists and makers who use creativity to innovate, disrupt, and elevate. Lisa Congdon is a globally recognized artist and illustrator, as well as a best-selling author of several books, including Art Inc., The Essential Guide to Building Your Career as an Artist, The Joy of Swimming, and her most recent book, A Glorious Freedom, Older Women Leading Extraordinary Lives. But Lisa didn't begin making art until her 30s. She was working at a good job, doing all the right things, but something didn't feel right. She felt more like an automaton. So she started to draw, hoping to find something that would wake her up and make her feel more alive. She did. Within a few years, Lisa had amassed a relatively large following and was able to devote herself full-time to life as an artist. Over the next 10 years, she grew her following on Instagram to over 149,000 people. She's had dozens of prestigious clients, including the MoMA, Harvard University, Martha Stewart Living, Chronicle Books, and Random House Publishing, and her work is shown privately and in galleries and museums around the world. But all that success came at a price, and in 2016, Lisa suffered from burnout. Physically and emotionally exhausted, Lisa had to find her way back to a place of health and happiness. In this conversation, we talk about everything from social media anxiety to the role of art in activism, the importance of having a clear vision and goals, an honest discussion about success, and why it's never too late to start your thing. May you enjoy this conversation, and may it inspire you to make your thing and change your world. Hello, Lisa. Welcome to the Creativity Habit Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. I start every interview in the same way, which is with your creativity story as a child. And that's just to get a sense of whether or not creativity showed up for you as a child, how it showed up, and just what were those early seeds, if there were any.
Well, in some ways, it's surprising that I'm a visual artist, because while I had a pretty creative childhood, it wasn't in the form that you might imagine. So my mom is actually an artist. She's a bit of a late bloomer too. She didn't sort of become a professional artist until she was older, like me, and she's a textile artist. And she's always made things and been a weaver, and started quilting when she was in her 40s. And we grew up in a home where I have two siblings. There was always some kind of creative project happening. You know, she was always taking us to art classes and engaging us at home in things to keep us off the television. This was the 1970s, and I think my mom sort of thought of herself as a bit of a, you know, revolutionary mom, right? That she was going to feed her kids whole grain foods and no sugar and keep us off the television. And she wasn't exactly a hippie in that way, but she was definitely super conscientious about those things. So we were always doing those kinds of activities, and also going to museums and being exposed to both visual art and music. And but I think the way that creativity played out for me the most as a kid was in play with my sister. So my sister's 2 years younger than I am. She's also super creative and artistic, and is a creative and a maker. And we spent hours and hours and hours and hours when we were kids playing with stuffed animals and dolls and Barbies and making up imaginary worlds and stories. And that's sort of how I was expressing my creativity when I was young. And I didn't actually even start thinking of myself as somebody who could paint or draw or express myself visually until I was much older, like in my 30s was when I started that. But I've always sort of delved into creative projects my whole life, starting when I was a kid, for sure.
You didn't proclaim yourself as an artist you didn't really get into art as any kind of profession, like you said, until your 30s. But in an interview, you said, when I discovered art, it wasn't like I'm going to be a successful artist. It was more like, this is the thing that makes me want to get out of bed in the morning more than anything I've ever done. So what is it, especially that time in your life, but what is it about art and drawing and writing that made you want to get out of bed in the morning more than anything else at that time?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think I can only express it by comparing it to the earlier years of my adult life. I went off to college and didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life and ended up getting a degree in history and thought maybe I might want to get a graduate degree in history. I loved to read and write, and then moved to San Francisco, got a job that I hated, and then decided I was going to go back to school to become an elementary school teacher because that felt like a way for me to sort of express my creativity and, you know, get paid. Like, the notion of being an artist didn't even enter my mind, as I mentioned. And then I just found myself in this pattern in my 20s and early 30s where I tell the story often about sort of waking up and realizing that I felt like an automaton. And I worked in an office where I was, my last job before I sort of left to pursue art was working at an education nonprofit. And I was really quite passionate about what I did. I felt really strongly about, you know, equity and racial justice and all the things that my organization had as part of its mission and vision. I loved my coworkers, but I felt like my life was very, I would get out of bed, I would go to work, I would come home. At the time, I was a competitive swimmer. I would go to swim team practice, I would go to bed. And those were all sort of healthy things. It wasn't like my life was a mess. I just felt bored. And so I went on this quest in my late 20s, early 30s to sort of figure out, like, what was it that made me feel inspired? I was depressed, basically, and felt no motivation. And I started exploring lots of different creative endeavors, kind of going back to my childhood in a way, and started taking classes and started sewing and making things. I discovered pretty quickly, like, I love this. This more than the job that I go to every day makes me want to get out of bed. So for a while I did both. And as you mentioned, I had no aspiration to become a professional artist when I first started drawing and painting and sewing. It was like purely this thing that just made me feel more alive. And so I, like most people, thought of it as a hobby and a thing that made me happy. And around the time that I was doing this was the fairly early 2000s, and the internet was becoming a space for creative people to share what they were making. Now, nowadays, it's like the internet as a space to share is sort of how we know it, right? There's amateur artists and professional artists and makers, like everyone's sharing everything all of the time. But in 2004, that wasn't necessarily the case. So I joined Flickr and I started a blog and I started sharing the stuff that I was making, again, with no aspiration to make any money whatsoever. I was like, I love this and I'm just sharing it. And I ended up meeting a lot of people who were sort of in a similar place and made some friends and started building a community online. A lot of people who lived near me, so I ended up meeting them in person and becoming real life friends. After a few years, I started getting inquiries like, can I buy this? I'd love you to have a little show in my store, my gallery. Have you ever thought about turning this into a product? And I was like, oh, wait a second. Everything shifted for me. And I started to think of not necessarily leaving my job and becoming a professional artist, but maybe supplementing my income and thinking about this in a different way. And that's how it all began in its infancy.
What inspired you to share it? Because a lot of people, like, we make things and then there's the fear of sharing it. And you just put it out there. Were you afraid to put it out there at all, or you just wanted to share it?
I think that, yes, but I think it's important, and maybe many of your listeners remember this time, but let's see, it's 2017. This wasn't in 2004. So 13 years ago, when I was starting to share and getting comfortable with sharing, not a whole lot of people were paying attention. I have almost 150,000 followers on Instagram now, but you know, in 2004, no one knew who I was. Like, I was just this 30-something woman who, you know, worked at an education nonprofit and did art projects on the site. I didn't have, not a lot of people were following my work, so it didn't feel that scary, because literally it was like my sister and my mom and like five friends at first. Mm-hmm. And I think it did actually become more scary when more people started to pay attention. So within a few years, I had amassed, you know, a following, and many of those people were also sharing and being vulnerable in that space. We sort of made it our job to encourage each other. I was having a conversation the other day with somebody who was on the internet early on, like me, sharing stuff, and that we really wish that everyone could have the experience of being on the internet at that time, because it was such a safe space and such a place for like community. There may have been internet trolls or mean people there, but they weren't necessarily in our world. It was this place where it was really kind of okay and safe to share. I go back sometimes and look at how much I shared back then, so much more than I share now. And in a way, I think it's because I didn't have a following and I didn't really think anyone was paying attention. So it felt fine. Now, I kind of grew up with the internet. And so slowly over time, as my following grew incrementally over the course of 10 years or so, I started to get more comfortable with sharing. But I was really lucky in that I got to do it at this sort of healthy pace, where a lot of people now go on the internet to share, and there's so many people and so many people we compare ourselves to. And then if we don't get the reaction we want, we feel bad about that. I feel like it's a much scarier place than it was then. And I feel very grateful that I got to enter that space at that time.
Well, I'd like to ask you about it actually from the present day, because I either read or heard you say, I'm not sure, where you mentioned that you still struggle with social media anxiety, which is a little bit of what we're talking about right now.
Yes.
Talk to me about what you mean by social media anxiety, and how both that you struggle with it, but also how you deal with that, how you meet it and keep going despite it.
Well, if you are a person who does not struggle with social media anxiety, you are in the, you know, probably 1% of the population, and you are probably very self-actualized and healthy.
Yeah.
Most of us, even those of us who consider ourselves fairly emotionally healthy people, suffer from it. And I think that we imagine that if we reach a certain point on social media where we have a certain number of followers, or we get a certain number of likes or comments or engagement on our feed, that somehow the anxiety about it will disappear, and that the level of comparison or anxiety we have when we're just starting out, it will suddenly go away, and that we'll become a sort of confident person. And that doesn't happen. I think there's always sort of this way that the same things that are hard in the beginning when you're first putting your work or yourself or your ideas out there, they just sort of grow. In some ways, as my following grew, my social media anxiety became worse. I should also say that there's a lot of attachment that we make to sort of social media as this indicator of our worth or the worth of our work. And no one is immune to that. I might post something that I've worked really hard on and that I'm super passionate about, and it doesn't matter how many followers I have. I'm always going to get a certain number of likes because I have like a very dedicated fan base, but maybe it doesn't get the normal amount or whatever. And I still am sometimes like, oh, maybe that wasn't as strong a piece as I thought. And so like we're constantly critiquing ourselves based on the reaction of other people. And this is a totally new phenomenon. I mean, 10 years ago, maybe on Flickr, we might have experienced this a little bit, Flickr being like one of the first kind of, like, we didn't think of it as social media, but this platform where people were posting things and commenting and blogs and stuff like that. But now it's at this totally new level. And I talk to people all the time who have even more followers than I have or a bigger audience, and they struggle with it too. this way that no matter where we are on the path, we're always sort of using it as a frame of reference for how well we're doing. And really, that's just so superficial. It's so meaningless. It's really the quality of your work. And sometimes the more experimental your work is, or the more you're putting an idea out there that might make other people uncomfortable, which are really good things, sometimes the reaction isn't what you get when you put stuff out on social media that you know people will like. And yet that's what we have to do to stretch ourselves as creatives. We have to push the boundaries. We have to try new things, you know? And so I always have to remind myself that sometimes if I don't get the reaction I want, it's because I'm doing the right thing, not the wrong thing. But there is this way that we use it as a frame of reference for judging ourselves and the worth of our work or the quality of our work. And I think that's really, really dangerous.
And it makes sense, because in the past, the way that we did that was with money and with the house size and the car. And it's not that we don't do that anymore, but so much of our world now is virtual, that it's as if like that way of having our worth be known to the world has now been transferred over to social media to a large degree. So now that's our external view. That's the view that people have into our lives from the outside.
So view is also very narrow.
That's right.
And in my case, it's on purpose. Like, I need to have a private life. I need to not share certain things. And so what people see is mostly pictures of my artwork or pretty pictures of my house, because honestly, that's what I'm comfortable sharing. Of course, I try to be vulnerable and write about things that are hard, but we don't see a full picture of other people's lives on social media. And often when we do, we're uncomfortable with that. We don't want to follow those people because it's like watching somebody have diarrhea like in front of us, right? And it's just like we can't handle it. So
that actually brings me to something that you said in another, or that you wrote. This is something that you wrote on your blog. You said, "I am not on this planet to please everyone or make everyone feel comfortable." I should preface this by saying this was in response to people's response to your posts about things happening politically at a political level. So you said, "I'm not on this planet to please everyone or make everyone feel comfortable. I'm here to share my art and my experience and to be a voice for what I believe in." That's right. "I might make pretty pictures, but they do not define who I am. I am a complicated, sometimes messy human being. I have past experiences that haunt me. I have regrets, hopes, and dreams. My views have been shaped by my experience as a woman and a lesbian, for example, just like your experiences shape your views. That's why on my Instagram feed and here on my blog, you see both the pretty things I draw and paint and occasionally of the other stuff, my struggles, my beliefs, my heartaches, my joys and contemplations, and my political rants." So the connection that's connected to what you were just saying, and what I wanted to ask about that actually more specifically, is that connection between art and activism. What do you see as the role between art and activism? And I know that you've also stepped up your expression on Instagram about what's happening politically since the inauguration, since this new presidency. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
I think that it's really mellowed out a lot. Not that people aren't still, artists aren't still sort of posting political stuff, but I think in some ways we have this new normal and we're all sort of fried by it. So I know that I'm not posting as much political stuff as I was, but in the beginning, many of us were. And I think for a lot of people who followed us, that was extremely refreshing and validating to see these people who, you know, others admire, like coming out and saying, "This is not okay," or "What this president is expressing is diametrically opposed to my beliefs," or "The policies are against what I think is right." And so I think there was a lot of affirmation happening for artists who were expressing themselves. But there was also a segment of a lot of people, especially a lot of people like me who are older. I think millennials who were making political posts got less flack. But a lot of us who have older followings, folks who live more traditional lives, you know, I have a lot of like women who take my classes on Creative Bug who just live in the middle of America and don't think of me as a lesbian or a political person. They just think of me as this person who teaches them to draw flowers.
Covered in tattoos.
Yeah, I am covered in tattoos. But so that would, you would think that would give somebody an indication that I'm not your average, you know, woman in middle America. But people see what they want to see. And so there was a lot of pushback in the beginning. It's completely mellowed out because I think a lot of people who are bothered by the fact that I was making these political posts and saying how I felt, and I can talk in a second about how I made sure that I framed those things, but that they were really bothered by that. Like, I'm not here to, they would say to me, I don't follow you because I want to know your political beliefs. I think your work is beautiful and that's all I want to see. And I was like, I'm sorry, I'm a whole person. And this is a time where I feel the obligation to speak out. And actually not to, I feel like, is a sort of expression of your privilege. There are people who spend their lives not being able to not speak up because of the oppression that they experience. And so I, as a privileged person, you know, while I might be gay, I am very privileged. I felt like it was my responsibility to speak out about stuff that was happening in the world. And that really bothered a lot of people. And they literally said to me, I'm here to see your pretty pictures and not the rest of it. Goodbye. And I was like, good riddance. And I wrote about it on my blog a couple of different times. And those people have by and large left. Every now and again, I get a flood of new followers. And then if I make a political post, some of those people leave. But part of what I do now, and I'm really glad that I did it, even though in the beginning it was hard. And I made sure, this is the point I wanted to make earlier, that I made sure that I framed everything as, here's what I believe in. Not fuck Trump, not this sucks, but instead, you know, this is why these policies bother me, or this is why his words offend me, because I believe in X, Y, and Z, and here's why I believe in those things. And I believe this is what America is about. And so I always tried to frame it as something sort of positive, filled with an expression of hope for the future, because I didn't want to be somebody who was, while I did feel and have felt and continue to feel downtrodden a lot of the time, mm-hmm. by the political climate. It's so divided mm-hmm. and so negative. I didn't want to be part of that negativity to the extent that I could avoid it. So that was really important to me too. And I do still have people who don't agree with me, who continue to follow me, and they're hanging in there with me. And that's sort of why I continue to make these posts, because I feel like the more we all speak out, the more things are quite possibly going to change.
Did you feel in the speaking out, when you started getting all that pushback, did that scare you at all? Or did you just feel like, that's cool, you know, these people are not in alignment. And if they want to subscribe, cool. If they want to stop following me, cool. Or was it like, oh God, do I want to keep doing this? Did you have any of that?
I didn't have any question about whether I wanted to continue to do it. Now, I'd be lying if I said a lot of the comments I got were hurtful or confusing to me. Like, there was a whole discussion on my Facebook fan page way back. I had wrote a blog post about being angry, and there was a debate among some women about whether anger was valid, which I just like found completely maddening. So for so many reasons, which I won't get into now, but yeah. So I was affected by it in that it was making me angry, and it was definitely affecting me and making me feel like, wow, we have so much work to do, even with among women in this country. But at the same time, I knew I was doing the right thing. I wanted to continue to do it. And I was getting so much validation and support from so many fellow artists and from so many of my followers. And I was inspiring them to also speak out, that I felt like I was part of something really positive, and I wanted to keep doing what I was doing. That's the great thing about social media. You don't have to follow anyone. Everything in social media is a choice. You do not have to look at anything you don't want to look at. And so if what I was talking about felt too challenging for people, or they disagreed, then they can go. And the truth is, I also gained a lot of followers as a result, because I became known as somebody who was actually speaking out about stuff that I care about. And it didn't just start after the election. I mean, I'm
right.
part of the LGBTQ community, and have been for, you know, since I was in my early 20s, and I'm almost 50. So it's been years, and I've always spoken about things that I care about, including, you know, racism on my blog and in other places. But it really kind of went to a new level after the election, for sure.
Yeah. And I will say that for myself, I actually often would turn to my Instagram feed to like get re-energized, because I could be so brought down. And then I would go to my Instagram feed, and there would be all these artists who were taking stands, and that gave me, not only did it re-energize me, but it really helped me feel like I was part of a community that was very, very important to feel, especially in the early months of the election. So I really appreciate that. Follow-up question to that in some ways is, when you were being interviewed, another interview, this with Debbie Millman, you said, "When I became an artist, I felt, how am I going to give back to the world? This feels like more of a selfish act than what I was doing before." So how have you reconciled that? How do you feel that you've given back through your art?
Well, it's interesting. So in the early days that I mentioned earlier, like where I left, I worked in education. I worked at this nonprofit where, you know, I was very attached to the mission and vision of the organization. I mean, part of my identity was wrapped up in being this person who made a difference in the world and who worked for good causes. And so, as you can imagine, I had no idea what my art career would become or how I would be able to express myself through my art and change lives or impact things. But at the time, I was like, oh, I'm just going to draw pretty pictures. And it did. It felt like this selfish act of, like, I was abandoning the stuff that I cared so much about and that had been my life's work to become an artist, which of course filled this other part of me that had been dormant and really in my 30s was really like blossoming. And so I felt very conflicted because on the one hand, I was so much happier making art and doing what I was doing, but I felt like I'm ignoring the problems of the world. But really pretty quickly, I'm very blessed because I have managed to build a career where I have, and because I've built it through social media, I have this audience who's very engaged with what I do. So I have this opportunity to impact lives. And I knew pretty quickly after my audience began to grow that I was going to use my power, for lack of a better word, because we all have power. And I had a particular kind of power. And I was going to use it for good. That I was going to figure out ways to be a positive impact in the world. And in some ways, that's just like through teaching people to draw and paint and talking about how important it is to like embrace being a beginner. I also talked a lot about getting a late start at art, and that became incredibly inspiring to a lot of women who were scared, who wanted to make a career change but were scared. So a lot of it was stuff that wasn't necessarily political at all, but it was like I was making an impact, and I realized that, and sharing my knowledge and skill was part of that path. And then along the way, I started writing on a blog, and I started writing very personal essays about things like gay marriage and the impact of racism on society and things like that. And then when the political climate changed recently, I was also writing about those things. And actually, I worked on the 2008 Obama campaign. I was asked to contribute artwork for that. And so there, you know, pretty early on, I was like getting involved in other causes through my art and doing pro bono work. And I just all of a sudden realized like, oh, I can have a positive impact on the world. You know, now I've like started an organization that we're about to make a nonprofit in Portland that is a community of LGBTQ and people of color who are in the creative and design community here. So like I'm in some ways I'm sort of like going back to my nonprofit roots through the arts, and it's like I've come full circle now, but it took me a long time to figure out that I wasn't selling out and that I wasn't doing something selfish by becoming an artist, that it's actually, in fact, in some ways I can make an even bigger impact than I could before.
Yeah. And I love what you said about the fact that just the way that you were living your life, that alone was making an impact. And I think sometimes I forget that it seems like, okay, this art piece, however, this piece needs to make an impact. But just the fact that the choices you made in your life and when you made them and how you made them, that alone was having its own impact. So there's a lot of ways that we make an impact and we might not be aware of many of them. So I just...
Well, and I think that's also why it's important to express that. I'm writing a book right now about finding your voice as an artist, and I was interviewing an artist the other day who is trans and Korean. And they were talking about how they realize that through their work, they are making an impact, not just as you said, the sort of like visual expression of art, but being an example of what's possible for people who are watching. That alone matters just as much as the art you make in some ways. And not everybody's comfortable doing that. And so I have no judgment for people who feel like they need to have a very private life. But one thing I did was I actually talked about my choices. And I was super vulnerable in that way. Ended up helping me connect with a lot of people out in the world.
I want to ask you about that, actually. So when you're writing and you're sharing vulnerably as you do, and it is a great connector, are you writing for a specific, are you thinking of someone particularly? Are you just writing for yourself? What space are you in when you're sharing that vulnerably?
Most of the time when I write an essay on my blog, or a shorter piece on Instagram, I'm thinking about my own experience, because I think it, first and foremost, this has to be authentic to me, and that I often, like, sometimes will brainstorm before I write a piece, like, what have I learned from this experience, or how did this experience impact me? But I'm also thinking about how other people might benefit from hearing my story, because I talk to a lot of, not necessarily younger, but artists, but often they're younger, but often they're just sort of women, even who are my age, who are just getting started, and they're very scared about certain things. And I'm always find myself saying, oh, I still experience that. Don't think that that's going to go away. Like, the key is actually to sort of manage your fears and anxieties and vulnerabilities around certain things and understand that we all share them. What makes me feel better often is just knowing that I'm not alone, right? That everybody experiences fear and anxiety and comparison and self-doubt. And sure, we want to work on not having as much self-doubt, but part of that is just understanding the universality of it. Like, I think it's comforting to know that everyone experiences it, because it's such a lonely feeling when you're in it. And so often what I'm trying to do when I write is just share my experience, because I know that there are people out there who, if they are like, oh, if Lisa Congdon feels that, then there's something about that that's makes me human to them, and not this person who just makes pretty pictures or on the internet appears to have this life that has no flaws in it. And that's just not true at all. Like, I'm completely human, and when and how I choose to share those things is sometimes tricky, but I try to do it because I think it is important for people to connect.
Well, and Lisa, you mentioned earlier about the idea that sometimes if we share too much on Instagram or something, it can be like watching someone have diarrhea. Like, it's just so what is that difference between sharing vulnerably and then watching someone just go, like, oh, really? I don't need that. Like, I don't share all that.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to butcher it, but Brené Brown talks about, there's in one of her books, there's something about oversharing, and I don't even know if she calls it that, but there's this way that, I think for a lot of people, it's expressing your vulnerability as a, like, these are all the terrible things that happen, but there might be a sort of like a victim, a place that a person comes from, or that it's just attention seeking. And usually when we're on the internet and we can feel the difference between somebody who's authentically sharing to share an experience of vulnerability with the goal of connection and the goal of feeling like you're part of a community of people who, you know, we all suffer and we need to be there for each other, versus somebody who doesn't have that sort of mindset when they're going into sort of oversharing. I don't want to judge, because some people love reading the yes. overshares or the sort of like feeding on other people's misery, or it makes them feel better about themselves when they read that somebody else is suffering. And so a lot of people both love writing that stuff and love reading it. And I have no judgment about that at all. For me, I personally, and it's not even what other people do that's my concern, it's sort of like how I choose to put myself out into the world. I always am thinking, like, am I sharing this because I feel the need to get affirmation, or am I sharing this because I have something of quality that I've learned from this experience, or, like I said earlier, that sharing this will actually help other people not feel so bad because I'm sharing the sort of universality of the experience. And I always try to use that as my filter. And it's hard, because sometimes hard things happen in my life and I don't feel comfortable telling the whole story. I've also had to let it be okay that some things in my life are private. and that they, I'm personally not comfortable sharing them, nor would I, do I think other people would necessarily be comfortable hearing them at this point. Now, time and space always help, and maybe down the road, I might share something that happened to me 6 months earlier. You know, it's funny, like you mentioned, when we were talking before we started recording the podcast, you and I were talking, and we were talking about the fact that I had written some blog posts about burnout. And I didn't talk about how burned out I was because I had a lot of shame about it for a long time. And then when I finally was talking about it years later, people were like, I had no idea. And I'm like, that's because I didn't share it. And I'm, because sometimes you have to wait and share things when you're ready. And then you can have that little bit of diarrhea for everyone else to read. But I like to have some separation from it. And so I always check myself when I'm about to potentially overshare something, that maybe I need a little space around it first. And that's just a personal choice and something that I need to have boundaries around. Because a lot, it's really intimidating when you post something really vulnerable and so many people are reading it. That does still feel really scary to me. So I'm very careful about that, mostly just for self-preservation.
And I think I do remember Brené Brown talking about how when we share something, to look at whether we have any, if we feel resolved around it, or if we're sharing it out of this, like you said, need for affirmation or validation, yes, where are we coming from with it? And I think it's true, if we don't have, if we share right in the middle of it, a lot of the times we're so muddied in our own thinking that we don't share it in a way that might necessarily be supportive and empowering to others. It just feels messy. So a lot of times it can be really helpful to come out on the other end and say, this is what happened.
And this is how I dealt with it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say there?
No. Okay. It's resonating for me.
Yeah. So actually, since you referenced that, let's talk about that, because you have experienced a tremendous amount of success, as anybody who follows you knows. I mean, it's hard to imagine people don't know who you are, but I'm sure they're out there. So you have had a lot of success. And one of the things that was fascinating, and you've talked a lot about, very honestly, you've talked a lot about the price of that success, and also as recently as May of this year, how you're dealing with kind of getting back into your own rhythm and finding yourself again. But so I'm going to back up, and then we'll come to as late as this year. But at one point you said, while I'm so excited for everyone who is just starting out now, I'm so excited for all of their potential successes and triumphs, and there are many to be had. I think it is important to understand that all of the hustling and hard work comes with a price. And then you said, I feel like there is this romantic notion about what it means to be a successful artist, and it's actually not romantic at all. I think it's really important to have honest conversations about what it takes to get there. So let's dive into that a little bit, about what that price is, what an honest conversation about what it takes to get there looks like.
Well, when you are in particular a working illustrator, and that's sort of like the most, I do lots of different things, but that's sort of what I'm known for and how I've made most of my living. There's the client list, there are the sort of projects you work on, which ideally we're told, you know, need to be increasingly more prestigious as we move through our careers. And illustrators actually don't make that much money. Like, you might land a job, you know, a job for an advertising agency where you're illustrating something that's going to go on a billboard or a TV commercial or something, and those pay pretty well. But those are rare. Most of the time, you're doing editorial jobs for $300 to $500 a pop or whatever, and it's due tomorrow. And so you have to do a lot of work to make a full-time living, especially if you live in a place like New York or LA or San Francisco, where things are a bit more expensive. And I was one of those people at the time. I lived in San Francisco, and when I was starting out. And so both to enhance my portfolio, my reputation, my reach, I just said yes to every opportunity that came my way. And I also recommended to people that they do that, like figure out a way to take on as much work as you can. That's a surefire way to build your career. And also do a lot of personal work on the side, because that's also going to attract people to your portfolio and to your Instagram feed. So I did all of that, and I did it well. And for a few years, it was okay. I don't have kids. I have a very understanding partner. And we, while we are, you know, our lives are very enmeshed and we have a very loving, healthy relationship. We also are very independent in many ways. And she was really great about like allowing me the space to grow my career, which was pretty early on in our relationship. Like we met as I was just starting out. And so she sort of watched me go from one extreme to, you know, from nobody knowing who I was and just starting out to becoming this well-known artist. And so within a few years, I started to feel the effects of both the hours, but also the mind space that it takes to hold so many projects, you know, energetically and in your brain, and the stress that that induces in most of us when we wake up knowing, okay, this week I have to turn this in, and then I got to go do this. And then, you know, and as my career grew, I was also taping classes for online venues, and I was getting asked to have speaking engagements, and I was writing books and going on book tours. So for me, it expanded from like working with illustration clients to working with publishers and venues and online platforms. And I was also have maintained an Etsy shop for the last 10 years where I make work and print it and sell it. And I do pretty much all of that myself. You know, occasionally I get help. So I was juggling a lot, and that overwhelm, I could only manage it for so long. And I really had a nervous breakdown about a year and a half ago. I just had a breaking point where I just became completely overwhelmed with the cumulative effect of just so many years of stress and so many projects and never being able to see the light at the end of the tunnel and always feeling like I was in a sardine can. And as you can imagine, I just started to not like what I did anymore. Like this stuff that used to make me really joyful, even my personal work, felt like a chore. And I was traveling and I was on like something like 28 airplanes in between 2015 and 2016. Yeah. And I was done. And I just said, I have to change this. There has to be another way. And I started making huge changes, and I'm happy to report that they're working.
So you're in the middle of all of this, of the nervous breakdown. And sometimes when we feel like we're drowning, it's hard to feel like we can come up for air because we don't know how to come up for air. We're just drowning. So where did you start to pull yourself up, and like how did you start to do that and find even just the little bit of space just to reflect on it and to start to make the changes?
Well, I want to say that I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's so true. Like after 10 years, I had gotten completely out of the habit of self-care or space, creating space for myself or saying no or any of that. So I didn't know how. And another thing that I want to say is that I was really scared that if I did, my career would implode. It was almost like, I don't have OCD, but like the only thing I can think of is that like I had obsessive thoughts about, I attached so much of my perception of my success with my work ethic and my hustling and my constant, that I thought if I don't do this, maybe everything will go away. It was like I was so afraid of breaking that if I stopped working so hard that all of a sudden clients would stop calling and I would stop having opportunities. And that's not what I wanted either, right? Like I wanted to still have a career. I just needed to do fewer projects. And I was really worried about what it would look like to say no and then also how to do it. So the first thing I did was I started saying no to opportunities. A friend of mine had given me this piece of advice once, like, if it's not a hell yes, it's a no. So unless I was incredibly enthusiastic about an opportunity that came my way or a project even that I invented in my own head that I wanted to, because I do a lot of personal work, that I wouldn't do it. And so at the time I had an assistant and I said, Kristen, anytime I get an email about anything, even if it's just a podcast recording with somebody, like anything that's going to take any of my time, let's have a conversation about whether this is a hell yes opportunity or not. And then, so she'd always ask me, I'd say, oh, she'd say, you got this email. She used to check my email for me. She'd say, you got this email from so-and-so and they'd love for you to do this and be part of this. And I'd think about it and I'd say, well, you know, that could be the, she said, but is it a hell yes opportunity? And so that became my filter. And so we started weeding out. And previous to that, I just said yes to almost everything, even if it wasn't a hell yes, right? Because I just didn't know how to say no, or I was like paranoid. So anyway, I started saying no to a lot of things, and I started, and immediately that didn't have an effect because I was engaged in so many long-term projects that it was going to take a while for the saying no to actually catch up, right? And it finally did. So after about 6 months, it was last winter, so I'm almost at a year point of having less on my plate, and I started to see the effects. Like, I started wrapping up projects that I had been engaged in for the last 6 months. I turned in a book, and I wrapped up things with clients, and I cut off opportunities. I had, had some ongoing relationships that I ended, and then I started having time. And this spring, I was really difficult for me because I finally had the time, but I, you would think that having that time would feel like some kind of glorious sense of freedom and relaxation. And in my head, I was like, I'm going to walk more. I'm going to go on hiking and I'm going to do all these things. And I was paralyzed with kind of like depression and anxiety when I first had the space because I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know how to relax any. I had been going a mile a minute for so many years. And so then I had to teach myself how to relax. And I started meditating. I worked with a meditation teacher. I started implementing a really strict schedule so I would have to take breaks. I kept up with, you know, not taking on more work than I could handle at one time. And I finally got to the place where I started to enjoy my downtime, but it took a really long time and it was like as much discipline and practice as an energy as I had put into working. So in some ways it was kind of exhausting, but I'm in a new place now. Like I just in the last couple of weeks, I got tendonitis in my hand. I needed to take a break. And I think 2 years ago or even a year ago, if this had happened, I would have completely freaked out. And I was like, oh no, I can take a break. I'll catch up later. It's fine. And I didn't sit around ruminating about not working or feeling guilty. I just went out and did fun things all week long because I couldn't draw or paint or work on the computer. So I did other things. And I was, it just struck me how far I've come and how much more I'm enjoying my life. And having space for fun and relaxation when it presents itself. And, you know, I still work a lot. I'm still really productive and prolific, but I'm not doing nearly as much as I used to. And I'm really mostly working on projects that, are hell yes projects that are, that really resonate for me. And that, also makes my work more fun.
I think one of the things that's so valuable about you sharing so honestly is most of life is a fantasy. Like wherever we disappear to, it's, whether it's the past, whether it's the future, whether whatever it is, it's a fantasy. And I, speaking for myself, I know I have a ton of fantasies about, oh, this is what it's going to be like. This is what success is like. This is what it's like when you don't have to work so hard. This is what it's like when you have a lot of free time. This is what it's like when you don't have a lot of free. And it just shows you, just as you were saying earlier, the universality of life, which is there's hard and there's not hard in all of it. And there's truth to the fantasy and there's not truth to it. And just recognizing it's all still just life. Whatever it is, it's life with all of the craziness and the complications and the beauty that life is.
So. I think that's so true. And I think that what I imagined success to look like was that, and a lot of, as you said, a lot of it was actually true. Like I did like a lot of the things that came with success. I make a very decent income. I don't have to worry about money anymore. I get a lot of accolades for what I do. I have extremely prestigious opportunities come my way constantly. And I feel those things. I have so much gratitude for them. And they are wonderful. But a lot of what also comes with all of that stuff is late nights, tendonitis, not spending as much time with my friends, feeling exhausted. And so everybody on their journey as a entrepreneur, I think, has to figure out, like, what's my happiest balance? Because you're never going to be completely happy or it's never going to feel perfect. But finding that place where you're working just enough to feel gratified and productive and all the those things that make you feel good, but that you're also getting enough time with friends and family, and you're, you know, and I think ultimately for me it was not taking my career so seriously. You know, like, I'm going to be fine no matter what. Even if I take on less work, success rate isn't going to slow down. I'm not going to become a nobody. Like, the world doesn't revolve around me and my work. Like, let me just be a, you know, like have a regular life now. I've worked really hard for 10 years and now I'm just going to slow down and maybe creep into the background a little bit eventually. But I think it is really true that we have these fantasies about
everything,
every aspect of life. And in reality, every aspect of life has hard things and easy things and good things and bad things. And just understanding and accepting that and learning from all of that is the important thing.
Okay, so we're getting close to the end here. I want to ask you a question, given what we've just been talking about success and then the slowing down of things, the role of clear goals and vision with all of that. Because I know, like you said at a point, I had a very clear vision about where I wanted to end up in my career. I knew what my goals were. I was very focused and I could see them very clearly. So I'm wondering about that balance between giving yourself the space and having that clear vision and goals. Like, how important do you think it is to have those clear goals and that vision?
I think it's still important to me. My vision just includes more space in it. And I don't always have a vision for what that space looks like. It's just sometimes it's just white. And I think meditation has actually really helped me to get comfortable with that space and then also to visualize it. When I think about my future now, I want to continue taking on projects. I want to continue to do things as an artist that are exciting. But I also want space around those things to just relax and embark on, you know, like I think so much when you're working so hard, you might have an idea, but then you never pursue it because you just don't have time to mess around and play. And I am trying to create more space for play and exploration and laying on the couch and staring at the ceiling and slowing down and not working at night or on the weekends and just having space for friendship. So part of my goals are around that, because I kind of do believe that when you set intentions for what you want to accomplish, you'll get there eventually, especially if those are clear and you believe in them. They may not take the form that you originally envisioned, but somehow you'll achieve them. That's been my experience. But at the same time, in my life now, it's just as important for me to have goals and visions of relaxation and play. So one thing I should say is that I've talked a lot, both in talks and I think probably some blog posts and probably on a lot of podcasts about being outside my comfort zone and constantly pushing myself outside my comfort zone. Like, my MO for the last 10 years has been being outside my comfort zone. My goals are around pushing myself outside of what's comfortable. So no wonder I had so much stress and anxiety. Yeah. My goal right now is to stay inside my comfort zone. Mm. I figured that out the other day, and I was telling my wife that I had figured that out, and that it was actually, I was very proud of myself because I realized my goal right now is not to get on as many airplanes and travel and get on stages and speak. My goal is to actually take on fewer projects. My goal is to say no to stuff that might just feel too hard or stressful, even though it might be good on my resume. My goal is to just be comfortable right now for a while and stay inside my comfort zone. And I'm giving myself permission to do that right now. And I'm actually like so much happier. So I'm not suggesting that people shouldn't push themselves, but there's a point at which it becomes, if you're constantly living outside of your comfort zone because you have these goals that are beyond your current skill set or experience, that can be a really stressful way to live. And I think we have to take breaks where we're just sort of allowing ourselves to be comfortable. And that's what I'm doing right now.
Absolutely. That's great. So before we finish with the last two things that I do at the end of every interview, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would like to speak to?
Sure. I have a book that's coming out next week.
That's right.
It's called A Glorious Freedom, Older Women Leading Extraordinary Lives. And it is a book of essays by, interviews with, and profiles of women over 40 who either, you know, reached the apex of their career later in life or are doing really amazing things at a much older age, or made some really huge advances or discoveries at an older age, changed their career. There's a lot of late bloomers in the book. That's sort of my own personal story. which is in the introduction. And then the rest of the book is profiles of other women in various forms. And the book is entirely illustrated by me. And it really was a labor, compared to any of the other books that I've written and illustrated, it really was a labor of love for me, because I think it's something that we don't talk about enough. Is like, you know, we're all living longer. And I think sometimes women think that they're past their prime when after they turn 40. And really, life just begins at that time.
I love it. I can't wait to read it. So great. Thank you for sharing that. And for everything else, to find out, to read Lisa's blog posts and to see where to follow her and to check out her art, go to lisacongdon.com, which is CONGDON.com. And the last two things is, one of them is just an appreciation for you. And my appreciation for you is, well, it ties back to where we started the interview, which is your willingness. And I get that a lot of artists were doing this, but that your willingness to take a stand. And I know this has been part of who you are from the very beginning, and it's been part of your career, your whole life in some form or another, but that you have used your life to stand up for what you believe in and to keep doing that, to keep being an example of a woman who does that, a woman for all of us. So thank you, Lisa.
You are welcome, and thank you for saying that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the last thing is, as part of the creativity habit, I believe that everyone is a creator, and some people are really called to make things. And for those people who are called to make things, why do you think it's important that we do that?
I think it's really incredibly important to listen to our deepest yearnings and to sort of figure out how to express those. One of the things I learned when I was researching and writing this book that I just mentioned was almost every woman in the book talked about how when they finally, and many of them later in life, listened to that part of them that wanted to express something that they had been holding back, that's when they started to feel happy or alive in a way that they never had before. And unfortunately, often that doesn't happen until we're older, and some people keep those things buried their entire lives. But expressing yourself creatively often comes with a lot of vulnerability, and it's actually kind of hard sometimes. It's not always a happy experience. And I think that's why we avoid going there. But if we don't allow ourselves to feel vulnerable or make stuff and put it out there to the world, not that you have to share everything that you make, but we'll never know what we can achieve or how that thing moves and touches other people. So I think it's important to express those things, because you never know what will happen as a result.
Great. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure. Thank you so much for including me in your lineup.
I'm Daphne Cohn, and you've been listening to the Creativity Habit Podcast. To read about the daily routines and practices of artists and makers, go to thecreativityhabit.com. You can follow The Creativity Habit on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you haven't yet, go to iTunes Podcast and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. And then join me next week for another Creativity Habit podcast. Thank you for listening.